Good afternoon, everyone, and it is my pleasure to be able to be here this afternoon and stand before you all, and I feel it a great blessing and a privilege, and certainly I'm very thankful to all the brethren and sisters of the Boston Ecclesia that's put all his hard work into the organizing of this gathering here, for which so many of us can take comfort and benefit from, take back home with us. So once again, thank you all very much for the great effort put out. This topic is for everyone. It is for all of us in this room. I think we should all be able to take something from it. Really, it's why we're here. It's what we're looking forward to, God's plan with his earth. When I was given this topic, I got thinking about it, and it seemed like I've been there, done this several times. And so rather than reinventing the wheel, I had taken a talk I had given previously and have tweaked it a little bit, put some new graphics into it. And so for those of you who have seen this before, it may seem a little familiar, but I hope I've added enough new material. It'll still be of interest to you. You'll still be able to get something from it. And really, I mean, you can see something 5-6 times or more and still get something out of it every time you see it. It seems like that's the way it is with me anyway. I've distributed a handout. It looks like that. If any one of you have not received that, please put your hand up, and we've got somebody that will get that around to who have missed anyone. Beth over there. Okay. I'm not sure whether we're going to be able to have time to, I've done a couple run-throughs on this, but it seems like it varies a little bit every time I do it, so whether we'll have time enough to go through every one of these points or not, we'll have to wait and see. Time will tell, but if we don't get through it all, at least you'll have the points that we've missed there. You can go through them on your own, but we'll do our best to cover it all. Our topic this morning is God's plan with this earth. Like I said, this is something that really is of interest to each and every one of us, because it's really why we're here. This is the divine purpose. It really involves the reason for our being alive, the reason for our entire existence. Yes, that would be good. The less light we can have in here, probably the better, the more vivid it'll make it. What we want to look at on this is the when, the where, the why, the who, the how, and finally, what it means to us. These are the things, the subtopics under here that we hope to cover. As we go through it, we'll see that most of it involves very much the how, this part right in here. That will involve a great deal of this talk. But we'll start with where. Where is this to be? Well, that's pretty obvious. It involves this earth, God's plan with this earth. What can be more obvious than that, right? But it's a particular part of this earth. It's a part of this earth called Israel, right down in here, right in the center of that crescent of what is now a crescent of crisis, really. And there's just a tiny little nation in there. When we look in our Bibles, we find that the whole purpose of God revolves around this people, the people of Israel. Whatever the Bible states concerning the international situation at the time of the end, we find that the nation of Israel and the city of Jerusalem are the pivot point for international affairs. Long ago, God declared in Zechariah 2 and 8, "After the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you, for he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye." It's a very tender subject for our Heavenly Father. It's a special area, a special people, and there's a special purpose involving all of that which involves you and I as well. The nation of Israel existed as a window to the ways of God for the ultimate benefit to all mankind, both then and now. It quickly became very clear to all people how God reacted to obedience and how he reacted or responded to disobedience. From Isaiah 43, we read, "Let all the nations be gathered together. Let the people be assembled. Who among them can declare this and show us former things? Let them bring forth their witnesses," he says, "that they may be justified." He challenges all the nations. Let them bring forth their witnesses if they can, that they may be justified, or let them hear and say it is truth. God says, "I can produce my witness. Ye, Israel, are my witnesses, saith the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen, that ye may know and believe me, and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God formed, neither shall there be after me." Israel, right there. And from Zechariah 12, "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be put cut in pieces. Though all the earth, all the people of the earth be gathered together against it." Being fulfilled to the letter in front of our eyes. All people of the earth be gathered together against it. All the eyes of the world are on that little location, on that little nation. Joel stated, or God stated through the prophet Joel, "Behold, in those days and in that time when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead with them there for my people, for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations, and parted my land. Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong." That is diametrically the opposite of what Isaiah 2 spoke about, beating the plowshares, the swords into plowshares. Here he's saying, beat the plowshares into swords. That has to be done first. Then we'll go the other way, as Isaiah has prophesied, and turn those swords back into plowshares. But look at that little statement there. Let the weak say, I am strong. What has happened in our world today? War isn't war like it used to be. There's no real front line on which the mighty forces of nations like the Western powers and the United States can really go in and fight their battles like they used to do in World War I and World War II. It's way different. And they're into a situation they really don't have a lot of experience with and really know how to handle. And it's this one right here. Let the weak say, I am strong. Let's look at that. 9/11. This is a link to a presentation we did right just a few days after that, or a week or two after that, because we're getting quite a few questions about, you know, was this predicted in the Bible? What's happening? What can we make any sense of this? You know, what we were hearing was words like the World Trade Center, and what we've heard, you know, then and since then, Israel, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, Islamic, Muslim fundamentalists, extremists, the holy war, the jihad, war on terrorism, Osama bin Laden, Ground Zero, Taliban. We hear a lot about democracy and freedom. We hear a lot about the Palestinians, and we hear a lot about the Hezbollah. Let the weak say, I am strong. And look what they're doing. How can we make sense of it? We go to that chapter that we read from Isaiah 2, and these are just two slides I've taken from as a link to that presentation, but it really says it all. There's no specific place in prophecy where it is prophesied about the events of 9/11. But in a general way, when you look at the prophetic profile that is established in scriptures, it is according to that profile. We'll look at verse 12. The Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty, against everyone who is lifted up that he may be abased, against every high tower, against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish. They're not exempt, these Western powers. Against all the beautiful craft, the pride of man will be humbled. The loftiness of men will be abased. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. The idols will completely vanish. It's not that it's just in these objects. The buildings are not in themselves wicked or wrong. But it's how man processes these things in his mind and how he internalizes them. And it becomes all about the idol, the worship of the unholy Trinity, me, myself, and I. And that is what comes out of this. And that is what is wrong with the things that are in the world today. It's how they are regarded. It's the pride of man. And it's because of how they're regarded that they will have to be brought down, and man will have to be humbled, so that the Lord alone will be exalted. And that is the objective, the divine objective, is the exaltation of Yahweh. It says, men will go into the caves of the rocks and into holes of the ground before the terror of the Lord and before the splendor of his majesty when he arises to make the earth tremble. What we saw in 9/11 was just a flash in the pan preview of what is to come. This prophecy relates to much larger events than that of 9/11, but that was just a little down payment, if you will, an earnest of what is to come. Because the present arrangement of things as it currently exists on earth has been designed to give glory to man, not God. That's the problem. That glory has to come down before God's glory can be truly manifested. So, back to our presentation. We go then to when. When? When will this happen? Well, there's a divine timeline. And it's kind of divided into sections. There was the Mosaic, Israelitish dispensation. And then there was the times of the Gentiles after AD 70. And then we might suggest that around 1967, those times of the Gentiles may have been over. And we're into now a period we could call the times of restitution of all things. The end of Gentile times and the restitution of all things when this rearrangement is taking place, and after which Christ will return. Prophecy of Christ calls, there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. They shall fall by the edge of the sword, shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down to the Gentiles, as is forecast of AD 70. Any forecasted or prophesied about the times of the Gentiles, thou Israel, shall become an astonishment, a proverb, a byword among all the nations, whither the Lord shall lead thee. And the Lord shall scatter thee among all people, from one end of the earth even unto the other. Thy life shall hang in doubt before thee. Thou shalt fear day and night, shalt have none assurance of thy life. And that is their lot throughout the world. where they have been scattered. Even in their own land, they don't really have any security. And it's interesting, that was prophesied not at the time of Christ or in the time of the apostles or in the prophecy of the Revelation or anything like that, way back in the time of Moses. Christ, or Ezekiel, spoke about this times of restitution of all things, and Jeremiah. Jeremiah, first of all, says, I am with thee, saith the Lord, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations, whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure. Then in Ezekiel, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, whither they be gone, and will gather them on every side and bring them down, bring them into their own land. The angels told the apostles when Christ was taken from them and ascended to heaven that he would send Christ whom the heaven must receive until the times of restitution of all things. That's when, around that time, that Christ would return. And there shall be signs, Christ told his disciples. It would be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, which is a biblical language for the political and ecclesiastical ruling institutions of the world. Upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves, or the instability of the general populations of the earth would be there, would be present. And the men's hearts would be failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Why? What's the reason for all this? What's behind all this? Well, we haven't really been left in doubt of that either. The great theme running throughout the scriptures about the divine purpose is this: all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. So will I make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel. I will not let them pollute my holy name anymore, and the heathen shall know that I am Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel. I will set my glory among the heathen. All the heathen shall see my judgment that I have executed. Thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself. I will be known in the eyes of many nations. They shall know that I am the Lord. It's very clear. As we can see on the top of the pages of our handout, a lot of this material is taken from a publication by Brother Grocott called The Last Terrible 40 Years, and we'll quote a few excerpts from that. It was in the 1973 Berean. He says, think of what is involved in pulling down all man's ugly buildings, demolishing to the ground all his crowded and vice-ridden cities, cleaning off the face of God's earth all man's rubbishy edifices and constructions, and building an entirely new, permanent, sound social fabric in harmony with the nature and the mind of God. Think of what's involved in all that. It says, even ignorant man himself is suddenly realizing that he is approaching the dead end of environmental disaster in all the destructively blind progress and civilization that he has been so obsessed in, so proud of. Think of the pollution problem. Think of the pollution problem. Can we have that? Would that be in the millennium? No, it has to be cleaned up. Things have to be turned around. All the works of ignorant and foolish man must be swept away, demolished, scraped to the foundation. The kingdom, in its transitional millennial form, is to be built for cleanliness and health and 1,000 years duration. How could any of man's flimsy, rickety, tinker toy productions have a place in that? For even now, man's proudest works are so quickly obsolete and superseded. Had some good examples of that just with technology. You know, we have to have a backup for everything because these things just might fail. Computers might go down. All the earth is full of idols, human memorials, churches, temples, mosques, synagogues. How could all these polluted things stand in God's glorious kingdom of purity and wisdom and holiness? There must be a thorough and drastic cleansing and purging of the earth itself and of the whole human race. Who is involved in this? There's a lot of players, and we'll see how they all interact with each other as we go through this. And I have so much to be grateful for and thankful to the brethren that have preceded me in this, because they have really gone through and established all the fundamentals and the brought out all the quotations relating to all these players that I'm going to put before you, display before you, that'll pass before your eyes on this presentation. Bible predictions describe the existence at the end time of two opposite world powers antagonistic to each other that will result in a final great confrontation, a confrontation like never has been in this earth before. The Bible talks about them as being a north and a south, as two diametrically opposed powers. And of course, those directions are relative to the land of Israel, the location from which the prediction originated. We have there the, you know, straight north of Israel and straight south of them. What is there? That's what we need to look. We need to look those directions. Daniel says, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass through the land of Palestine. And at that time many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. It has a history, this king of the north and king of the south. We go back to the before the time of Christ, the time just after Alexander the Great. And there were two opposing forces in the earth relative to the land of Israel at that time. And it had to do with the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And those kings that were always going at each other back and forth through the land of Israel. And of course, it was desecrating the land of Israel and Jerusalem almost every time they did it. And that has become a parable, as it were, of a similar kind of thing that will happen at the end time. There's these two powers. They're still in that same direction relative to the land of Israel. So let's look at these. Who in the world would we look to find the king of the north, for example? And we turn to Ezekiel 38, and the first thing that we find there is that he is told to set his face against something called Gog, or Gog. And we find when we look it up, that Gog describes a great latter-day leader. This term is not really the proper name of a person, but a designation of a position. It indicates one at the top. It indicates the head of a great alliance or a confederacy of nations representing all the great historical world empires that have ever existed in the earth. And we look to the Nebuchadnezzar's image as representing that, with his feet standing in the eastern and western parts of the Roman Empire that occupied those countries. Nebuchadnezzar saw an image that had a head of gold, which represented, of course, the Babylonian Empire, the breast of arms in silver of the Medo-Persian Empire, the belly and thighs of brass was the Greek Empire, the legs of iron was the Roman Empire, and then we come down to the mixture of iron and clay feet, which 10 of those represents the 10 basic nations composing the founding nations composing the European Union. Those, in the history, that image has never stood complete. on its feet. It's either being the head, or it's being the breast of silver, or the belly and thighs of brass, or the legs, or the feet, but never in its entirety. But at the time of the end, it will stand in its entirety and represent all those dominions that have ever been a world empire in the past. The Gog will represent all that has ever existed, a composite of everything that has existed in past history. And where it is to be is of the land of Magog. And when we go to Strong's Hebrew Dictionary, we find that he was a son of Japheth and also a barbarous northern region inhabiting a land that was related to the ancient Scythians, who spread westward along the banks of the Danube and occupied the areas of Central Europe, which is basically close to present-day Germany, give or take a bit. And probably occupying also some, are comprising some of the eastern countries of the Warsaw Pact. Then the next term was the chief prince. And when we again look at Strong's, we find the word is Rosh, and it means the head. It means an exalted one, a king or a sheik, a captain, chief, cloud, governor, prince, ruler. So we'd look, for example, and we'll select this word chief. This word in the language of which the Bible was written is Rosh, and which is the ancient form of Rus, from whence is derived the name Russia. This being so, we have this incredible phenomenon that Russia is directly named with reference to Bible predictions. And it occupies pretty much the land that we have put there in this dark, shadowy form. Now, we've used colors here to kind of symbolize the different powers, and black or the dark, because to Israel, in the Hebrew, north was a place of blackness and of darkness. So whenever we will put something and try to represent something that was of that land or that area, we'll use a very dark color. And probably we should use the color brown for the southern areas, because brown, or the south, was the area of the Negev in Israel, which was a desert. And so we could represent that by brown, but because of the color of the satellite map that we have here, we've used a different color, and as you'll see as we go along, we use green to represent the forces of the south. And we'll use blue to represent Israel, and we'll use yellow in the sun to represent Christ and the saints and the righteousness and the faith of tried gold. Next one we have here named is Meshech, and these were descendants of Japheth, the son of Noah, who after the flood settled in the region north of Persia, up in this area, and from whom descended the Muscovites, who migrated to the banks of the Muscova River, named after them, and that has later become the site and namesake of the current city, Moscow. And we have the name Tubal next. This is another son of Japheth, whose descendants migrated north to the regions of present-day Russia. The river Tobol was named after them, and on that river is situated the great eastern metropolis of northwest Siberia, the city of Tobolsk. And he goes on in verse 5 of the 30th chapter, he names Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya, he says, will be with them. Persia, this land here, once occupied a large area including present-day Iraq and Iran. Ethiopia and Libya point to much the same areas then as they do now. Again, the boundaries aren't the same as they are today, but it's the same general area. And the fact that it says that they are with them, they're with this King of the North power, indicates that at the time of the fulfillment of this prediction, these three areas will be aligned with that King of the North, or the Russian power. Then we have named here Gomer and all his bands. Well, Gomer from Josephus, when we look at Book 1, Chapter 6, Section 1, he identifies these with the Galatians or the Gauls who migrated west to the areas of France and Holland and Belgium, etc. And we've depicted that in the roughly the same area as what France occupies today. Then he talks about the house of Togarma with the of the North Quarters. Well, Togarma is in the same locality as Gomer, but instead of going westward where with their brethren who went up into this region of France and Netherlands, as it were, they diffused themselves over the North Quarter, that is, the north, relatively, again, to Judah, to Judea. So we're looking probably at the area of Turkey. And he talks about many people with thee. There is a lot of others. There's many people. Well, who would that refer to? I'll suggest perhaps that, you know, like Nebuchadnezzar's image had iron feet of iron and clay with the 10 toes, indicating a power made up of a composite in the region of the image, 10 national components, which we call the European Economic Community, includes many small nations in addition to what the nations that we have named, and that would be in this area. So we see the the image standing on his feet. Let's look at the King of the South. We'll pass on quickly here and see if we can identify this King of the South. Well, he names Sheba and Dedan, all the merchants of Tarshish. Well, Sheba and Dedan occupied areas, parts of the Arabian Peninsula down in here. Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof. Tarshish was a merchant marine superpower, identified the areas around Gibraltar up here and India over here, and eventually Great Britain way up in here. Young lions would probably indicate the British Commonwealth of Nations, independent countries that have branched out from her, including the USA and Canada, perhaps Australia as well. All those areas that have been her offspring, the young lions, the offspring of the lion. And perhaps the area of Jordan, we know, is very friendly to the Western powers, which used to be the area of Moab. Okay, now we'll get on to probably the biggest part of this presentation is the how. How is all this to play out? And this is kind of where we come into the handouts. Follow along on that. And the first part of this will cover the first, well, we'd call it the first 20 years, but really the most of it is occupying the 10 years. And this is where the term the 40 years comes in, because this chart takes in 50 years. But the first 10 years are really to do with the return of Christ and the advance of Gog on the regions of Turkey and Egypt. And after that is where the 40 years comes in, the 10 years down to the just before the construction of the temple, and then the 1 hour with the beast, or the 30 years after that to the millennium, beginning of the millennium. And that's a close-up of this first part that we'll cover. Well, first of all, of course, Christ returns. That's in that first 10-year component. Resurrection and judgment, we think, will be in the regions of the mountains of Sinai. That's generally been the area that's been put forth. Malachi says, "Unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings, and ye shall go forth and grow up as calves in the stall." The Son of Righteousness, an apt description of Christ. So we've represented him as a son. "The same Jesus which is taken up from you into heaven shall so come in like manner as ye have seen him go into heaven. And God hath appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained." And that means us. When that happens, we must all be gathered and appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. So we all gather from all over the world, will be brought forth to that place to be judged. While that is happening, there are other things happening in relation to these powers of the north and king of the north and the king of the south. Ezekiel 38 continues on. At the time of the end, the king of the north shall come against him. And that probably is a reference to Turkey, come against Turkey like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, that area of Jordan in there, out of his hand, and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And in a little later, it is said that he would, that this king of the north will ascend and come like a storm, like a cloud to cover the land. So it's really kind of a fitting way that to represent this, like a big, dark, overshadowing cloud over the countries. And he comes down and occupies. Christ and the saints are not inactive during this period. Because the next one, the next item on your handout there is Christ and the saints going forth to subdue Midian and Cushan or Bozrah, same area, synonymous areas, Cushan or Bozrah, and establish a nucleus of the kingdom of God in those regions. The Lord came from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. He shined forth from Mount Paran, came with 10,000s of saints, we're told in Deuteronomy 33. God came from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and drove asunder the nations, Habakkuk. And again, Habakkuk, I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Brother Grocott comments on these things, these events. He says, the kingdom will begin from a small central nucleus and then grow and grow until it fills the whole world. This is the picture that prophecy gives us, as in the case of the leavening of the bread or the little stone that struck the image. We see that, too, in fittingness. Wherever Christ advances, he must transform. To pass through, he must conquer. He recognizes no human authority. He must be supreme wherever he goes. He cannot pass through and leave a land as it was under the old human dominion, nor can he devastate without transforming and restoring. He doesn't just pass through a land and leave it in ruins. He transforms it into something of beauty and cleanliness. This would wholly, to leave it just in ruins, would be wholly out of harmony with his mission of filling the earth with the glory of God. So we realize, as soon as we think about it, that the picture Brother Thomas gives us of a gradually expanding kingdom, bringing transformation and blessing as it extends, is the only fitting one. To reach the Holy Land, he goes on from Sinai, Christ must pass through the southern desert. And this is Christ and the saints at this time, the chosen. He must therefore make it his own dominion, begin his work in it, subdue its inhabitants, abolish all human institutions in it, beautify its land, lift the curse, and fill it with God's glory. The kingdom of God has begun. A door has been opened in the political heavens. Christ and the saints have a headquarters and a base of operations. Once he has entered an area, he has taken rulership over it as his rightful owner, the heir of the earth. And once he has taken the rulership and responsibility for it, he must abolish human evil and begin his reign of righteousness and justice and blessing. The old and new cannot coexist in the same place. So first, the southern desert, Midian and Cushan, is possessed and glorified before Armageddon. Then all the covenant land from the Mediterranean, the Euphrates, to the Euphrates after Armageddon. Now this isn't Israel, brothers and sisters. These are the Arabs. These are Arab countries. It's to them that Christ appears first and changes and transforms and establishes his nucleus of the kingdom. And isn't that interesting? You know, when we look at the arrangement of the Arabs and with their Muslim faith and how they're arranged and positioned in the land, And here we see how they're represented in terms of the Shiites and the Sunnis, the Sunni populations. And it pretty much puts a line through the ones who will be ready and willing to accept Christ and the ones who won't. It isn't just that. There's more complexity than that, but that's a big component of it. And it probably is a bit of a key to why Christ will be reasonably well accepted in those lands of ancient Basra and Ammon and through there and Moab and Egypt. And this is just a different map with the same distribution. So we'll go on to number 4, where we have Britain and the Western Alliance are the first to recognize and accept the true nature of the new power in Basra. And there's a move to protect Jerusalem by the southern power. And the Jews are relatively, at that point, dwelling safely. They're under a protection and guard of the king of the south. The land of Israel is brought back from the sword, gathered out of many people, brought forth out of the nations. They shall dwell safely, all of them. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble this king of the north, who is now positioned down in the land of Egypt. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. He's challenged. He feels insecure, and therefore he has to take action. As saith the Lord of hosts, it shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and thy bands and many people with thee. And there's a confrontation there between the king of the south, who is the protectors of the land of Israel, and the alignment, the front lines of the king of the north. Sheba and Dedan were told in Ezekiel 38, and all the merchants of Tarshish, all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? They're confronting them. And in that confrontation, there will be an outcome. All nations are gathered against Jerusalem to battle. Gog is victorious in that battle. The allied powers, the king of the south, are defeated. 2/3 of the Jewish population are slain, and they're driven back. It shall come to pass that in all the lands, saith the Lord, 2 parts therein of Israel shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. Not an easy time for Israel, and not an easy time for the king of the south powers either. The Jews that remain in Palestine will take cover in the regions of Moab, still occupied by the western powers of this king of the south, who will have submitted to the new power in Basra. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab, Isaiah says, or the Spirit says through Isaiah. Be thou a cover to them from the face of the spoiler. So they flee out and take cover in the areas of Moab and also in the areas of Egypt in a little later time. This last time of Jacob's trouble, says Brother Grocott, is clearly the worst and most terrible of all its blood-stained history. Worse than the Assyrians, Babylonians, Romans, and even Hitler. For years, the Arabs, egged on by Russia and the papacy, have sworn to destroy Israel from the face of the earth. We are told that in the last invasion, 2/3 of the people of the land will be cut off and die. So it becomes really clear from both prophecy and from present utterances that the papal Gogian confederacy proposes to solve that Jewish question once and for all. Gog consolidates his power base in the land of Israel. And from there he marches against this upstart power in Basra. He gathered them together in a place called Armageddon. And it shall come to pass at the same time when Gog shall come against the land of Israel, saith the Lord God, that a fury will arise up in thy face. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and broke them to pieces. And was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, all broken to pieces together, became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. That's Armageddon, part one. The remnants of the Gogian enemy are destroyed from the land of Israel, as predicted in Ezekiel 38, verses 19 to 23. So I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith the Lord. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. It will be like a civil war. I will plead against him with pestilence and with blood, and will rain upon him and all his bands, and with many people that are with him, an overflowing rain, hailstones, fire and brimstone. I will magnify myself and sanctify myself, that they will know that I am Yahweh. The Gogian enemy in the land, meanwhile, is destroyed. It's reduced to 1/6 of its forces by its own mutual self-slaughter, and by the pestilence and judgment of the elements that are brought on them by God. And so the sixth retreats back into the areas of Assyria. God's land is at last completely free of its enemies. Then Christ and the saints, number 10, deliver the remnant of the refugee Jews. There is a refugee of Jews that had not only fled to Moab, but had also fled to the land of Egypt. This isn't the second Exodus, not yet. But they are brought back also out of the land of Egypt. And he shall pass through the sea with affliction, and the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away. And then Jerusalem and its area is cleared for the return of the remnant that were brought out of Egypt and that were in Moab, and they were to be able to return and go back to their land and to their city. Christ and the saints, which are now termed the rainbowed angel, will begin their victory march to Jerusalem. And in the process of that, there is a worldwide earthquake that's predicted by Zechariah. The Mount of Olives is split by it, and there is a great valley formed. And there's besides a primary fault line running up through the Great Rift Valley, which comes out of Africa, and through the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee that follows up the Jordan River, there's also a secondary fault line called the Judean Fault Line that runs up very basically the way this yellow line is here. And Zechariah says that the Mount of Olives will cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and the west. Half the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. And there shall be a very great valley. This is from the Google Earth, is how this appears. And the fault line was brought up very much by this red line. Jericho is there, Jerusalem is at the top, and the River Jordan is down near the lower part here. This is the kind of land that they would have to be traveled through, but it won't appear like that because there will have been a way made for them by this earthquake. That's a very low-resolution picture, but that is the old road of Jericho to Jerusalem, much like what Christ would have traveled on. Very rough country. So you can see for a host like Christ and the saints, there's a passageway made through that. And as we go up there, we go right up close to the area of Jerusalem. Here's the Mount of Olives. And here's the Temple Mount in here, a little closer up, the Temple Mount, Mount Zion in here. And this will split in the process of that earthquake. So they would form a very great valley. And up that valley, Christ and the saints will come. March from the Jordan Valley through this new valley, formed by the earthquake, right up to the area of Jerusalem. Then will be this song: lift up your heads, O ye gates, be ye lift up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? It's the Lord, Yahweh, strong and mighty, Yahweh mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, Even lift them up, ye everlasting doors, the King of glory shall come in. His feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives. And they, all these people that have come back then to Jerusalem, the delivered Jews, will look upon me whom they have pierced. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. And there shall be great mourning in Jerusalem. Christ and the saints are enthroned in Jerusalem in the immediate area, and there's, scriptures predict, 7 months for the cleaning up of the land. And that 1/6 remnant of the enemy are pursued back into Assyria. They're not just left alone there. They are pursued back into that area. It shall come to pass in that day that I will give unto Gog a place there of graves in Israel, and there shall they bury Gog and all his multitude. They shall call it the Valley of Haman Gog. There'll be 7 months in the burying of them. And it shall be to them a renown the day that I shall be glorified. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for lo, I come. The land is purified and glorified. The kingdom of God spreads throughout the land and eventually throughout the world. And at that point, there is a completion, or at least a partial completion. The first part of that is accomplished, the completion of the conquering of all lands that are promised to Abraham from the Nile to Euphrates. That part of it is accomplished. There's a completion of the regenerating and disciplining of Egypt, Israel, and Syria. The original entire area of Eden is opened up, brought back to be inhabited as the Garden of God, restored to its former condition of peace and beauty. And that is predicted in that day. There will be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria. And the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. And they will be a third, along with Israel and Assyria and Egypt, even a blessing in the midst of the land. That's a prediction that will take place there. And then the events continue on from that point. The next thing we see is the construction of the temple in Jerusalem, the house of prayer for all nations. Walk about Zion, go all around her, count her towers, mark well her bulwarks, consider her palaces, that you may tell it to the generation following. Again, it's all to the glorification of our Heavenly Father. This is the area, basically the area of Zion that it'll be built on, the Mount of Olives over here, Mount Moriah, the Mount of Olives, I should say, over here, and Mount Moriah is here, the Temple Mount in Zion is here, and that is the area of the earthquake will have gone right through that area and have leveled that place and has set a scene for it. Dimensions are enormous. The total area is 36 million square feet, an effective area for approximately 20 million worshipers. That is, it'll have a capacity for a little over a million worshipers at any given time. And the frequency of the visit is everyone shall go up even from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts. So the capacity, assuming a 24 hours of duration per worshiper, would work out to 1.25 million worshipers per day, or 450 million per year. It's a big, huge amount of people that it will have capacity for. In the area of the corner towers, where there will be the kitchens, as it were, for the feeding of the people, there are 5 levels, each level large enough to accommodate 5 football fields. And there will be an altar right in the very center. The total area of the altars is 1.5 football fields. It's a huge area. There will be a conveyor for sacrifices. There will be streams of living water flowing out of it. Be in a great place, a wonderful place to witness, to be there and see it. Then there will be the proclamation of the everlasting gospel. We'll go forward from that point to the whole world. As is predicted in Revelations, I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to them that dwell on the earth, to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. Then there's a regathering of the 10 tribes. This is the work of Elijah that will go forth from there. and go into the countries of the earth and overspread them with his work and identify and bring out all the people that have to be gathered in and back to the land from the countries where they have been scattered. When the first part of the Armageddon battle took place, the image was smitten on its feet, but it wasn't yet totally destroyed. There was still a remnant left, the 1/6 that had fled back. So there's still a remnant there. And so it's spoken of that there's a grinding of the image to powder, in which the lion, the bear, the leopard kingdoms that were seen and prophesied by Daniel will be totally subjugated. Let me just take a look at how that would look like. You see this image totally ground to powder, and the land would be subdued. But there's an area the Roman beast remains, and this we've depicted as kind of a streaked red and black area where the Roman beast, the Confederacy, the mother of harlots, is still there in the earth. This is a religious-political combination of power and authority in the earth that will wield great authority throughout the world. It's depicted in Revelation's mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, abominations of the earth. Just like the image of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar's image depicted all the empires of the world that ever existed. This woman embodies all the traditions of religious traditions that have ever existed in the world. That image will be ground to powder. The Judah will rally. There will be an army formed by Christ to carry war forth to the nations. And these armies of Judah will move north to free the Jews in other parts of the world. And we see those stars turning into tanks. And they are there as armies of Christ to bring out their brethren, the 10 tribes. Bring them back to the... And there will be great conflict in doing that, almost like civil war in the nations where those areas are, and they bring back their brethren, the 10 tribes, to the land of Egypt. And, excuse me. Hitting the wrong thing here. And we have the second Exodus that comes out of that land. The Jews are gathered to that land, into the land of Egypt, and that's the 10 tribes, and they're brought forth then and cleansed and baptized, as it were, through their passing through the waters. There's a papal resistance to the rule of what it regards as the Antichrist by this Roman, this great beast that exists, the Roman beast. And it's interesting that that we have the sort of the public perceptions of Antichrist, and we see how that will prepare them to think that what Christ is the Antichrist. Because they believe, this is from a typical Protestant website, that the Antichrist shall walk into the newly built last days temple of Jerusalem, take a seat upon the mercy seat inside the Holy of Holies, and he will proclaim to the world that he is God Almighty. This event is probably perpetrated by the future Antichrist in the midpoint of the 7-year covenant which he arranges with Israel, granting Israel permission to rebuild their temple on the Temple Mount. They'll look at that and they'll say, that's Antichrist. Same from the Catholic encyclopedia. The fathers of the church speculate they show the temple to be the Jewish temple rebuilt by Antichrist in Jerusalem. Rather than the Bishop of Rome, the early fathers identified the Antichrist as a government official, a king coming to power in the ruins of the Roman Empire. He would probably be Jewish. Possibly from the tribe of Dan, he would then seduce many of the Jewish people by attempting to fulfill the political aspirations they held for the Messiah. Yeah, how about that? Judah is used as Christ's bow and Israel as Christ's battle axe to take Europe, Rome, papal and other leaders, and this is Armageddon Part 2. The Rome and the Vatican are destroyed by an earthquake and volcanic eruption. Rome descends into fiery abyss and smoke rises. We kind of see a representation of, we have by icons and arrows here, how this might occur. Maybe the armies of Judah go out into the nations. And this Roman beast doesn't just occupy this area of Europe and it has spread. The influence has gone wherever. And in fact, if you look at the populations, how they're arranged through the earth, you get a map of population disbursement of various religions of the world. It looks very much like this, like I've depicted on here. They're represented by this lines of red and black of Rome and their harlot daughters throughout the earth. That's their locations. And they are to go out into those areas. And we have the prophecy of Babylon the Great is fallen. The merchants which were made rich by her shall stand afar off for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing. And there'll be a great holocaust. There'll be things like this happening. We saw just a preview of, as it were. And there'll be scenes like that. It won't be nice. It won't be pretty. And when that happens, it's taken out of the way, and God's glory replaces it and spreads through the earth. There's still a part of the world that has to be cleansed, however. The remainder of the world inhabited by the others, and there'd be the religions of the Islam, Muslim, Hindu, and countries of India, Japan, China, Africa, etc., will also be eventually subdued and converted. And that will be the areas that are left here, that aren't shaded in the yellow areas. So Christ and the saints via the medium of the armies of Israel and Judah go into the remainder of the world and convert it to conformity with the divine purpose. So we see that happening in much the same way as what's happened with the other parts of it. And God's glory fills those parts of the earth as well. Jews, number 29, are regathered, settled in their tribal allotments in the land of Israel. And finally, number 30, 31, and 32, the temple is completed, consecrated, the first Passover celebrated. Nations begin to go to Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And we'd have a scene like that. The house of prayer for all nations. For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And then the millennium begins. As truly as I live, the same verse we started off with at the very beginning. Truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. There's just one very short part that's left. What does it mean to us? We always have to bring it down to that. Whatever it is we study in the Bible, what does it mean to you and to me? Time is running out, and there is nowhere to hide. Nowhere we can take shelter from, except in the hands of God. The message of the prophets is unequivocal. They cry with one united voice that we stand before a God of judgment and that our misdeeds will be remembered and that the Almighty will mercilessly punish the evil and the unfaithful, even as he saves the righteous. The prophets seem to say, go ahead, do what you want, but remember this, as you do now, so will your deeds be weighed later. And if you have pandered to your lower selfish self, beware. And the question always is, am I ready? Are you ready? There is a time coming. We can't stop it. It's happening. And it will happen just as surely as it happened to Israel and Judah 2,000 years ago when Christ came to them first and they didn't recognize him. And great destruction came upon them. Let it not happen to us.